Pardon me?
You a stapler by any chance?
No. Are you? Okay, so there's an exam on Friday, as you know. If you have a class next hour, and you have a whole hour to take the exam, but you can come 15 minutes early if you want to. If you come early, you go to the room at the far end of the hall down here, 111. Okay, how many people think they might like to do that? That's about typical. Good. Okay, and I'll have a review session this evening. Okay, so this exam, remember, is not going to be on the thing. Yeah, well, yeah, I think it's 119. It's on the website, and it's on the last slide here, too. Yeah, in WLH. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to talk about the shape of hydrogen-like wave functions. Now, what do we mean by a hydrogen-like atom? Do you know? It's an atom that has just one electron. It can have any nuclear charge and mass you want, right? But it only has one electron. Obviously, that's going to make the thing very much simpler, because if there are two electrons, they're going to repel one another, and then things really go to hell in a handbasket, as they say. But at least if for one electron, we're really on top of the situation, because we can use that table to write out the atomic wave functions for anything that has just one electron, any atom that has just one electron. Okay, and there's a neat program that allows you to do that. Unfortunately, only on a Mac. There's a sort of version of it that works on a PC, but it's not as good, I don't think. And for this, we're indebted to Dean Dowger, a physicist at UCLA, who's also a juggler. There's a picture of him, and here he is actually juggling at an Apple convention. He's a big Apple enthusiast, which is why he made this. Okay, so I put the program up here to look at it. So it's called Atom in a Box for no very good reason. I mean, the reason is that people, when they taught quantum mechanics, always talked about a particle in a box. And the potential they chose for that was something that was a square potential. You have a constant potential energy here, and then infinite sides here and here, so the particle has to stay in the box, right? That's a very unrealistic thing. What we talk about of, you know, Hooke's law, Morse potential, are much more reasonable, right? But that classical problem that was used to teach was called a particle in a box. The reason they did it was because you could do the differential equations for a thing like that, and you couldn't do it simply for these other shapes. But since we're not solving the differential equations anyway, just letting that Erwin thing do it to get a curve that will work, we don't have to worry about that unrealistic thing. But anyway, that's why it's called atom in a box. So what is there in this program? There's a picture on the left that shows the wave function. The neat thing about it is that it's showing the square of the wave function plotted by what's called ray tracing in computer graphics, where the brightness of any point is the amount you'd see if you send light through from the back, how much stuff gets attenuated, say, right? So every bit it passes through. So it's how you would see electron density if you could see electron density. Okay. Now, you have lots of control over the thing here. Just for reference, you have there the Schrödinger equation. That's always there. You could erase it if you want to, because you know the Schrödinger equation. Then it also has the nickname, the name of the orbital you're plotting, N, L, and M, remember, characterize it. And also in parentheses, its nickname, 1S. Right? Now, you could get a much fancier orbital here. You can either go here to change what L, L, and M are. You can go up to 7 if you want to. Why don't we go to 7? Right? There's a 7S orbital. And if we do that, it's a 7P orbital. Right? And if we do that, it's a 7D orbital, F, G, H. So you can actually plot all these things. And then the other neat thing you can do is rotate it. You see here in this cell here, there's a Cartesian axis, and you can grab it and rotate it any way you want to. Now, that's not making any difference, but if we tilt it this way, now you can see the shape of the thing. Right? Okay, so that's neat if you want to do that. So you can plot them. But there are other things here, too. You have here the actual formula that you're using. Remember, when you take one from column A, column B, column C, multiply them together, this is what you get. Remember, for the 1s orbital, it's very easy. It's a constant times e to the minus, and it's written out here, not rho, but z over a zero times r, right? So that's what the thing is. And notice that here it's much more complicated for this orbital, right? What that is, and it also has these cosine things in it. Good. Anyhow, so you can do that. It's the square of that that's being plotted, the electron density. Okay, then you have what energy it would have, and it gives the formula for the energy here, or here, right? Which you'll notice is proportional to it's some constant stuff, times the atomic number squared, divided by the quantum level squared. So that's what we actually saw that before. Remember that when we did the Coulombic one-dimensional thing, that the sequence of levels went with n squared. Remember that up to zero when it got completely away. Okay, so that would turn out to be 13.66 electron volts in this case. Okay, now I have two questions to ask you about this this particular wave function shown here, the 1s. One question is, where is the density highest? Lean? Yeah, at the very center. And it must be that because it's e to the minus r. When r is 0, that's a maximum. It falls off from there. So obviously that's not a hard question. The density, you can see it. You can see it analytically as well, that it's at the center, that the density is highest. Now, here's a question that might at first glance seem to be the same question, but it's a different question. What is the most likely distance, the most likely single distance? Yeah, Nate?
A0.
What?
A0.
How do you know?
Because that's the highest value of the wave.
If
the amplitude is the highest,
so the square would be the highest. It's not the amplitude that's the highest there. The amplitude of the wave is the square of this. Where is it maximum? At 0. The maximum's at 0. But you've seen plots like this before, haven't you? Right? But why does it have the maximum here at A0, not at 0? See why that's funny? And the reason is that you have to do surface weighting. Now let me show you what surface weighting is. Right? You weight by, if you multiply by R squared, you see this has got an R squared time. This is the square of the radial wave function. The other part is nothing, right? That's this part that's being squared. The only other part is a constant. But you're multiplying it by r squared, so obviously it's getting bigger as you're going out because of r squared. It's getting smaller because of this exponential drop-off, and that happens to be where the maximum is. Now, why do you do this surface weighting? It's easy understood by an analogy, and the question, which is heavier, rubber or lead? How many think rubber's heavier? How many thinks lead's heavier? At least a few people bid on that. Why did you others not say so? Okay. Because suppose you have a basketball made of rubber. Its density is 0.9 grams per milliliter. And an official basketball has a shell thickness of 1.6 millimeters, so it has a certain mass, right? Here's a lead sinker that you would use if you go fishing. It has a density of 13.4 grams per milliliter, and it has a radius of 1.6 millimeters. Okay? Now, which is heavier, the basketball or the lead sinker? This is a no-brainer, right? The basketball is much heavier than the lead sinker. Why? Because there's much more rubber there. even though the rubber isn't as dense. The radius of the basketball is 1.122 millimeters, and the radius of the sinker is only 1.6. You have to multiply by how much surface there is. Okay, everybody sees that, right? So you have to multiply by the surface if you want to know how much stuff there is there. The density is one thing, but how much volume you have is the other, which is surface, if you have a thickness of 1.6 millimeters. Okay, so you have to multiply by r square because the surface goes up with the square of the radius. So that's why you have to put this r squared in here. Because, and we'll rehearse the problem just with one more example here in the case of a 3s orbital, which has a node here and also a node here. You know that there are going to be two nodes because you have a quadratic equation which has two roots, two places where its value is zero. Okay, now, here are two different shells, right, like the skin of the basketball, number one and number two. And we're going to ask two questions again. Which shell has the higher density? And that's a no-brainer. You can see that the density is higher in shell number one. But we'll ask a different question. Which shell contains more stuff, more probability? And now you have to multiply by the square of the radius because there's much more there in the big sphere than in the small sphere, right? And if the shell 2 has 3 times the radius and 9 times the volume for a certain thickness, right, of the shell of number 1. So it turns out, as you can see over here, to be more, to have a higher. This is that shell. This is the green shell. There's more probability in the red than in the green, even though its density is lower. You multiply by r square. And that's why this thing is different. So that most people, when they come to this course, if I say, where is the electron most dense, are really amazed that it's at the nucleus that it's most dense, because they've seen plots like this, right? But it's most dense at the nucleus, but its greatest probability in a share of a given in a shell of a given thickness is out further because you multiply by that. Is that clear to everyone? Okay. Now there's lots of interesting information in this atom in a box. For example, you can do a slice of the orbital. Let's just do it for this one here to see what it's like. So if you click slice here, then you get two pictures. The one on the left is the same one you had before, and it has a little notch in it there that shows where you're slicing through that to get this picture. Okay, I think that's what it is. Anyhow, this one shows that. So here we're way far in front of the picture. Okay, so we hardly slice through it at all. You just see a little bit of this donut that's going around here and this red donut that's going around here. You see a little bit of those. But as I move in toward the center, I begin to intersect different parts of it. Right? And when I get to the center here, right, I'm now cutting right through the middle of the thing. So these are, you know, two-dimensional plots, you know, the density on that surface. The one on the left is actually what you would see if you look through the whole thing. Okay? Now, so it's at different levels. There's one level, another level for this particular 3D orbital. Now, of course, you can see the nodes and you can see the energy. There are nodes there, obviously. Now, if we look at that 3D orbital over here, which we can go back to the... So you can use NLM, but you can also click here to go down. So here's 3D, a particular 3D orbital. And then we slice through to see the nodes. And you can see what we were doing. If you rotate it, you can see that this has a donut around the... You've seen pictures of that orbital before. It's got a donut of density around the sort of dumbbell in the middle. Okay, now, it has... But you can see that it's axially symmetric, right? So the node that we see in this... The nodes we see in this slice, this X here, is actually part of a cone. Everybody see that? It goes around like that, a node. The node is a double cone. Okay? That's characteristic of having D orbitals, to have that cone. Okay, so that's a 3D orbital because it has that nodal pattern. Okay. Now, what's this one? It also has that cone, right? But it has another node as well. What's the other node? Can you see? Right? It's a sphere. What a sphere is like is an S orbital, right? If you have only spheres, it's an S orbital. If you have 1S, there are no nodes. If you have 2S, there's one sphere. If you have 3S, there are two spheres. If you have 4S, there are three spheres, and so on. Right? But if you have this cone, then it's a D orbital. So this has an extra node. So that one. So it's a 4D orbital. Right? It would be 3D if it had only this cone, but now having another node, it's 4D. So you can begin to understand how these things go together to give different shapes. And this is reminiscent of what we saw last time with Chladni figures, where you have both diameters and circles. In three dimensions, you have both spheres and cones, and also planes. What's a plane? A planar node characteristic of what kind of orbital? Yeah. A P orbital has a plane. A D orbital has a cone. Right? Okay. So, and it's the same also as in the Chladni case. Remember, there are several different ways of getting the same pitch in the Chladni disk. Different combinations of lines and circles gave the same pitch. And here, different combinations of nodes, spheres, planes, cones, give the same energy. Okay? So you have, you know, the 3D, the 3P, and the 3S are all equal in energy. Is that true? Are they all the same energy? They are true. It says so here. The energy, remember, depended only on Z squared over N squared. They all have the same energy. That's not true if you have more electrons. But if you have only one electron, they're exactly equal in energy. Just like the Chladni things where you get the same pitch. Okay. Now, let's look at scaling these H-like wave functions as you change the nuclear charge. Okay? When you change the nuclear charge, you change the size. How do you think you change the size if you make the nuclear charge bigger? Right? Good. Okay. You change the electron density. Obviously, if you shrink it in, the density goes up because the sum has to be 1 over everywhere of probability. And the energy changes. Now let's look at how each of these changes as you change the Z. The size we know easily because remember, they all have the same, if you use rho, they all look the same no matter what Z is. But rho is scaled by Z. So as you make Z bigger, you get the same rho for a smaller R. See what I mean? The scale changes when you change Z. And suppose you double Z, how much does it shrink? If you double Z, by what factor does it shrink? Factor of 2 to get the same position on the wave, which is a function of rho. Right? In rho, they all look the same. But that changes with R that scales as you change Z. So it's linear in the nuclear charge. If you have twice the charge, you have half the size in linear dimensions. Okay? So if you had hydrogen plus 1, carbon plus... if the nucleus was hydrogen, carbon, or potassium, all heavily plus, and you put one electron in each one, those charges rate are the 1 over the... that is, the distance would change by 1... 1/6 and 1/19. So, if you were to look at the scaling of the size, if that were an H orbital, and you could hardly see it because it's not very dense, it's all spread out, this would be the size of a carbon, and this would be the size of potassium, but very much brighter because all the density is in there. Now, how much density? How much does the density increase? You know, you could answer that just out of your head. Suppose you shrink it by a factor of 2. How much does the density increase? By a factor of 8. Because you shrunk it this way and this way and this way by 2 in all those. So the volume changes by a factor of 8, but you have the same stuff inside, right? So it has to go with the cube. But you could also see it in, by these normalizing constants. Remember, the integral over all space has to be 1, the probability of the square of psi. And when you look, and that's the reason you have these various constants in there. And if you look at the constants, they have z to the 3/2. So when you square it, it's z cubed. So obviously it's scaled by z cubed. The higher z, the higher the density. Okay? So that's quite straightforward, and you saw it already. So the density at corresponding positions, that is corresponding values of rho, like at zero, for example, the density really changes drastically for the hydrogen, 1 electron, carbon, and potassium. They go as 1 to 216 to 7,000 almost. So the potassium is very, very, very much more dense than the hydrogen is, 7,000 times denser at corresponding positions, right? Where have you seen that before? Experimentally, that potassium is really dense in its electron. How could you see that? In X-ray, right? Remember the picture we saw where potassium really stood out? So it's easy to see heavy atoms because A, they have more electrons, and B, those electrons are held much closer. They're very dense, so they're very easy to pick out in an X-ray picture. But hydrogen, by the same token, is very difficult to locate, so people don't normally find hydrogen in X-ray experiments. Now, how does the kinetic energy change as you change Z? Well, if you have the psi is some function, and it's a function of Z times R, right? Because a function of rho. Okay? So the derivative is z times the derivative of the function, and the second derivative is z squared times the derivative of the function, right? And the kinetic energy, remember, is psi, the second derivative divided by the value, so it goes with z squared. So the kinetic energy goes with z squared. Okay? How about the potential energy? Well, that depends on Coulomb's law. And Coulomb's law, you know, is 1 over R for the energy. Okay? But it depends on the charges. If you doubled the nuclear charge for the same distance, how do you change the energy, the potential energy? If you double Z. It's obvious, right? You double the potential energy by doubling Z. But that's not all you do. You certainly do that. At a fixed distance, that energy is proportional to how big the nuclear charge is. But that's not all that happens when you change the nuclear charge. You not only change the energy, what else do you do? You suck it in. So it's closer. Not only is it more energetic at a normal distance, it's sucked in by the factor Z as well. So there are two ways in which Z does it. It shrinks the distance as well as changing the energy for a given distance. Right, so the potential energy is proportional to z square when you do that. Okay, so obviously, if the kinetic energy is proportional to z squared, and the kinetic and the potential are both that, the total energy is proportional to z squared. So this is that formula that you were looking for the problem today about what's the energy of an atom, 1 electron atom, and it's proportional to z squared divided by n squared. Right, and the constant happens to be 314 kilocalories per mole, and that's with if Z is 1 and N is 1, that's the 1s state of a hydrogen atom, then that's how much energy it takes to rip the electron away from the proton. Right, it's the ionization energy of hydrogen is 314. Okay, so we know a lot. And it's that this is rehearsing what I said earlier in the day. Remember, we saw this already in the 1D Coulomb, that here's the lowest energy, the next, and how far they are down from E0 is 1 over N squared, right? This one is, in three dimensions, is 314 kilocalories down. And notice that it doesn't have anything to do with L and M. It depends only on N. So in a 1-electron atom, the S and the P and the D and the F and the G and the H are all the same energy in any given quantum level. And we'll see shortly why it's different if you have more electrons. Okay, so just to summarize what we just said, it's proportional to 1 over z in size, and therefore to z cubed in density. And the energy is proportional to z squared, and also incidentally to 1 over n squared if you have higher energy levels for this one electron. And the size is actually n over z if you go to higher levels. So that's quite straightforward. Now, more information from atom in a box. There's the possibility, it says there, of doing superposition. And you'll see here what's interesting about doing superposition. Let's go to, just to make it a little simpler, there's the 2p orbital, which has the numbers 2, 1, 0 for m, right? Can you see what orbital that is? Look at the coordinate system here. And I'll move it around a little bit so you can see. There it is looking at it from the end, and here it is looking at it from the side, and so on. What orbital is that? What would you call that one? 2pz. Now, what happens if I make the m up here 1 instead of 0? What do you think I get? Guess. Pardon me? 2px, or maybe 2py, right? But this is what I get. And this is sort of weird. And if I tilt it down so we look at it along the z-axis, it looks like that. And if I in display show time evolution, show how it varies in time, it's like this. Okay. Can you guess what would happen if I did -1 instead of +1? Isn't that neat? Now, the reason it does this is because, not too surprisingly, a physicist wrote the program, right? And physicists are very interested in isolated atoms, right, which have what's called orbital angular momentum, as you see here, right? But chemists are more interested in atoms that are near other atoms. And when there are other nuclei nearby, it turns out the electrons don't orbit. The orbiting is quenched. So much more appropriate for chemistry problems is orbitals that point in a given direction. That's why you think of px, py, and pz, because chemists have told you about that. Had physicists told you about it, they would talk about m equals 1, m equals 0, m equals -1, and they would have things that orbit. Like that, right? Those two ways of looking at it are both correct. They're just simpler for different problems. So if we want to take this physicist's program and make it appropriate for chemistry, we do what's called a superposition. So we have now, we're adding together here 2, 1, -1. In this particular case with 2, 1, 0, but I'm going to change it to be 2, 1, 1. And now what do we have? What orbital is that? It's still varying in time, as you see. But the color, incidentally, corresponds to what's called phase, because the physicists deal with complex numbers for how big something is. Right, so it's both real and imaginary parts, and the color tells how much is real and how much is imaginary, and the total is the same in all cases after squaring. But our point is, what's that orbital that is drawing there? See the coordinate axes? It's the py orbital. And what do you think I would get if I made this instead of plus 2, 1, -1, which is that, if I made it -2, 1, -1, what's that one? 2px. So the 2px and 2py are made as the sum and difference of the physicist's orbitals. And by the same token, we could say the physicist's orbitals are made as the sum and the difference of px and py. But for our purposes, we use px and py because they're fixed in space the way things tend to be when there are other nuclei around. We'll talk some more about that. Okay, so that's what this is here. Now, So that's what the physicists with m equals 1 or m equals minus 1 have orbital angular momentum going one way or the other, and the phase is a complex number for them. It's much easier for us. Okay, so here's the chemist 2py, which, as we just saw, is the sum of these two. Okay, now we're going to do... we're going to think about multiplying and adding wave functions. It's important to keep in your head straight. This stuff is sort of complicated, right? It really isn't so complicated, but it certainly seems complicated at the beginning. But one thing that will help keep it straight is sometimes you multiply things and sometimes you add them. And just knowing when you do which is important. Okay, we already saw a case of multiplication, where you multiply pieces, functions of r, theta, and phi, in order to get a one-electron wave function for the atom, right? That was a case of multiplying little pieces to get the one-electron wave function, okay, a three-dimensional wave function. Those three can be spherical polar coordinates, r, theta, and phi, and in that case, you can multiply things together. But it's a one-electron wave function. That's what an orbital is. An orbital is a one-electron wave function. What's it a function of? Position of what? Of one electron. An orbital is a function of the position of one electron. How many variables? Three. X, Y, Z of that electron, or R, theta, and phi. Okay? It's simpler when you write it with rho, theta, and phi here. Okay, so that's the case of multiplication. But we also just saw addition, right? We could add two of those orbitals, the physicist's orbitals, and get the chemist's 2p orbital. That was a question of adding things. And adding atomic orbitals together in that way is called hybridization. Have you heard of hybridization? Yeah? That's what it is, just adding two functions together. Okay, so you can take a 2py plus 2pz is a hybrid orbital, right? It would be one that has orbital angular momentum, in fact, as we just saw over there. Or we saw the reverse of it, but it's true. Okay, now, that's a hybrid orbital, 2py plus 2pz. What's it a function of? What is this function a function of? How many variables do you have to put in? Six or three? What's it a function of? It's a function of position of an electron. That's what an orbital is. It's a function of the position of one electron. This is a function of the position of that electron. This is also a function of the position of the same electron. So when the electron is here, this assigns a certain number, that assigns a certain number, you add them together. That's adding the two functions. A hybrid orbital is still an orbital, a function of just the position of one electron. It doesn't involve two electrons. It's a function of what? Being an orbital, it's the function of the position of just one electron. But you can get a number that comes from adding two other numbers. Okay, and that's what we did in order to do this. It was complicated in this case because the physicists' numbers were complex, right? They had these funny properties, but we don't have to worry about that. But you can add them in other cases as well. For example, you can change orientation by hybridization. Let's look at a case like that. So here's a 2pz orbital, and there's the 2py orbital, right? The 2pz was red on the left. The 2py orbital is red on the top. What do I mean by red and blue? In this particular case, I mean positive or negative, right? It's the sign of the orbital. What sign does that number have that we're talking about? Bear in mind that what's being shown here is the square of the orbital. But the square root of that is the number we're talking about, which can be positive or negative. Obviously, once you square it, it's all positive. But it's colored here according to whether the psi that it came from was positive or negative. Okay, now, X was red here, positive in this region, every place to the left of that plane, of this plane, the one that goes through the nucleus. The 2PY is positive every place above. When you add them together, what kind? Suppose you add 50-50. What are you going to get in this quadrant up to the top left? Positive numbers. What will you get in the quadrant down to the bottom right? negative numbers. And what will you get in the other two quadrants? They'll tend to be cancellation. Right? In some place, they'll be zero. Okay, so let's look at what happens if we make our hybrid orbital a certain fraction of 2PY and a certain fraction of 2PZ. Okay? It's a weighted sum, depending on what A and B is. Notice when I choose A, B is determined if I want it to be normalized, right? If I want the total to be such that when I square it, it sums to 1 everywhere. If I make A bigger, I have to make B smaller. Okay? So, let's look at an example. Suppose we take a 50-50 mixture of PZ and PY. Can you guess what it's going to look like? What orbital will it look like? D orbital? S orbital? It'll be a P orbital, but it'll point a different direction. There it is, a 50-50 mixture of PZ and PY. Okay? Now, suppose it weren't 50-50. Suppose I had another mixture. Suppose I used 75% of PY and only 25% of, or 75% here and 25% here. Can you guess what it's going to look like now? Right here. Or suppose there's 50%. Suppose there's only 25% PZ. Right? And obviously, 0% PZ is doing that. So when you add two P orbitals together, you get another P orbital that's in between them. And so you can adjust the direction of a P orbital by how much you mix of one another by this hybridization. Okay, so that's changing orientation by hybridization. But you can also change the shape by hybridization. Here's a real physical problem. Suppose you have, this is a 2s hydrogen atom, right? How do you know it's 2s, not 1s? Because it's got a spherical node, right? Okay, so what would happen to that 2s electron distribution if I put on an electric field? Would the atom move? If I put on an electric field, would it move the atom? What's the charge of the atom? Zero. It's one proton, one electron. So the atom won't move. How about the electrons? The electrons should shift one direction and the nucleus shift the other direction. Okay, so we know qualitatively what's going to happen. The electron density is going to shift one way or the other if we put a field on. Now, how do we write the wave function that does that? Bear in mind that the fields we can put on are really tiny compared to the field that the electron feels because it's near this positive charge. That's an enormous field. So it's going to have to stay looking something like what it looks like now. Right? It's not going to change wildly. But it's going to shift in the direction that shifts the electrons one way and the nucleus the other. Okay, so we can change that shape by hybridization. The virtue of doing it by hybridization is we're going to make it look like these orbitals that we know are correct when there's no field. Right? We're going to use those and mix them together a little bit in order to shift the electron density one way or the other. Now, how can we do that? Suppose we take a certain amount of S and a certain amount of P. Right? And we call this an SPN hybridized orbital. And what does the N mean? It's a weighted sum. It can be more S or more P. And as we vary A and B, we can get anything. And we can express that ratio. If we square it like this to get probability, we have A squared is the fraction that looks just like the density from 2S. And B squared is the fraction of the time it looks like 2PZ. And then there's this cross term as well. Okay, but N, SPN, like SP1, SP2, SP3, you've seen those, that's the ratio B squared over A squared. It's how much S and how much P, right, is in there. So it, in fact, it's B squared over A squared. So it's what fraction of does it look like the P orbital? So for SP3, it's 3/4 like the P orbital and 1/4 like the S orbital. Okay? SP2, it's 2/3 like the P orbital, 1/3. SP is 50-50. Okay, so let's look at this. So suppose it's zero. What does that mean? If this is zero, there's no B, it's all A, it's a 2s orbital, no-brainer. Okay? Now, suppose we make it, we put on an electric field that tends to shift the electrons in that direction. Can you see how we're going to do it? We're going to do it by adding to the numbers here, which are positive here, negative here. We're going to add numbers that are negative in this region, and or probably negative in this region, and positive in this region. So we reinforce here, cancel here, and shift things to the left. Right? So there's only a point, SP.02, okay, or SP.04, SP.06, SP.09, SP.11. So what's happening as I put a little, as I put more and more p orbital? It shifts further and further to the left, right? I keep hybridizing to do this, okay? Or there's a quarter, or a third, or 50, or now it's 1-to-1, that is 50-50, right? Equal parts. And it turns out that that is the maximum extension is for SP1 hybrid orbital, okay? Because can you see why it doesn't keep going that way? What happens when I go all the way and make it a pure P orbital? Suppose I keep adding P, right? Keep doing it now, watch. Right, so then it shifts back. But SP hybrid shifts the electrons as far as you can by mixing S and P, 2S and 2P. Got the idea? That's what a hybrid orbital is. Okay, and you can do it on the program if you want to. Okay, so this allows adjusting to new situations, for example, applying electric field, while preserving the virtues of real solutions that have the right curvature and so on, right? For whatever the nuclear potential is, which is the big game in town. Okay, and now we come. So we can do a lot with one electron wave functions in this program, right? We've done a lot today already, right? So why don't we, if we're so good, why don't we just go to two electron wave functions now and keep going? Okay, now what will it be a function of psi if it's a two electron atom? We assume that the nucleus is so heavy it stays at the origin, so we don't have to talk about its XYZ. What's psi going to be a function of? Position of what? So how many arguments? Six. So we're going to have R1, theta 1, and phi 1 to describe electron 1, and also R2, theta 2, phi 2 to tell us where electron 2 is. Okay, it's obviously more complicated than before, but wouldn't it be neat if we could simplify in the way we simplified the one electron wave function, where we can say this complicated function of six variables is in fact the product of this function, which we know for one electron, and this function, which we know for the other electron, if it were the only electron there. If we could just multiply them together to get this complicated function, then it would be much easier to understand, because we already understand this and this. Right, and that's what we did before with the atom, right? We had an R function, a theta function, and a phi function, which would have been very complicated if we're X, Y, Z all mixed up with funny functions involved, right? But this one will be simple if we can do this. So the question is, can you do that? Can you write it to multiply one electron wave function? Now remember, an orbital is a one electron wave function. So what this says is that the two electron wave function is a product of two what's? Two orbitals. So we can understand a many electron atom as a product of orbitals. That would be really neat, because we really understand the one electron ones. Okay. Now, if that were true, then we could square it to get the probability. Now, this is a joint probability. This is the probability that density, that electron 1 is at this position, and at the same time, electron 2 is at this position. Okay, and that probability could be the probability that electron 1 is at this position, independent of electron 2, times the probability that electron 2 is at this position, independent of electron 1. You multiply the two probabilities together, and you get the overall probability. You've seen that kind of thing before. Okay, so that's what we want to do. It seems plausible. If so, if we could do this, then we're golden. Because then we can do it for more and more electrons and multiply all these orbitals together and get the many electron wave function. The total energy will be whatever energy 1 has plus whatever energy electron 2 plus electron 3 and so on for all the electrons. The total electron density will be whatever density electron 1 had at a position plus whatever electron density 2 would have at that position, and 3 and 4 and 5, add up all the electron densities at that position, you get the total electron density at that position. Seems, makes sense to me. Right? So the whole is the sum of the parts. If we can divide it this way, electron by electron, orbital by orbital. And you've seen things like that. Like the neon atom is 1s squared, 2s squared, 2px, blah, blah. You've seen that? That's assuming that the neon atom has this orbital and this orbital, two electrons that one, two there, and so on and so on. So we get the overall picture of it quite easily. But the crucial assumption is that the many electron wave function can be written as a product of one electron wave functions, of orbitals. So two or more electrons is a problem in joint probability, as we just said. Like tossing two coins in order to get two heads. So here's two coins, if I can do this. Whoops. Did I get, yeah, here we go. So what's the probability that I got two heads? This is not a hard problem. What's the probability that I got two heads? What should you bet on that? Right, it's 1/4. Because the probability that one will do it is a half. The probability that the other will do it is a half. The joint probability is the product of the probabilities. That's all we want to happen here, is for that to be true. Okay? Now, I could actually win a bet with some of you who are naive by saying that I could flip it so I'll get two heads half the time rather than a quarter of the time. You want to bet? Do you know what I'm going to do? Two heads. Right?
Yeah.
What's different? Why isn't the probability a quarter? Because they're not independent of one another. I taped them together. Right? It's not that. That's only true if they're independent. I put a piece of tape on them. Right? So now it's different. Now, here's the question. Can we do the joint probability for two electrons as the product of their individual probabilities? Why not? Aisha?
Because both of them are repelling each other, so they're not completely
independent. Right? The electrons are not independent. They repel one another. Right? They tend to stay apart. So there's no way they could be independent because they repel one another. So this problem that you cannot possibly write a many electron wave function as a product of orbitals and expect it to work. Orbitals, in principle, cannot work if you have more than one electron. That's why we focused on hydrogen-like atoms, one electron. There you can do it. But with more electrons, you've got great problems. That's not true anymore. Right? So, you can't do this. Orbitals can't work. Right? So on this downer, we'll have the exam on Friday. Fortunately, this is not on the exam, right? And then after the exam, we'll try recovering from this, right? But here's the... So there, you can take the exam at 10:15 in the room down the hall, room 111, or at normal time here and stay till 11:30. You have an hour to do the exam. And I'll do this review this evening, 8 to 10, in room 119 WLH. Which it depends on when you want to take it. Oh, no, you go there if that's where you're taking it. Yeah. Let's see, we'll leave that for now.